This is Robert Stark. I'd like to introduce today's guest. His name is Dota.
Hey, how are you? Thank you for having me here.
Your website, I will give out the name of your website. It is Occident Invicta. And I've known you as a commentator. You've been a commentator on Robert Lindsay's site. And you came out with your own blog along with another commentator from that site, a Bay Area guy.
Yes, that's true. We had we're all-time commenters on Robert's blog, and this was essentially Bay Area guy's idea. And I said, sure, you know, we could do this. It'd be an interesting experience, and we've got a lot to say, clearly.
So I'll ask you about your background. So you said, are you originally from India or from Dubai?
I'm actually Indian. I was born in India. I lived there for a few years, then moved to Dubai. And then move to Canada.
So some of these issues that you discuss in your blog, were they influenced by your experiences in those different places from comparing the culture in India and the culture in Dubai and then finally going to Canada?
Interesting question, actually. Well, throughout my university years and throughout my 20s for the most part, I was actually quite liberal in terms of foreign policy, socially and everything. And then with time, actually, with the passage of time, specifically during my late 20s, I started moving more towards the right. Many of the arguments of the left simply didn't make any sense to me, and their ideas didn't fail to resonate with me. And so I kept moving to the right, essentially. But I don't really identify myself as a mainstream conservative because I do disagree with many of their issues and platforms. And so I see myself more as a paleo conservative, you know, as an old school conservative.
So I guess one thing we can talk about is your comparison of these different places. What are some of the biggest contrasts that you've seen between, say, Canada and Dubai? You mentioned that that is a very kind of a there is sort of a racial hierarchy in the. What's the name of the nation? Is it the United Arab Emirates?
Well, there are these. Well, the UAE is the country, and then it's basically you've got a bunch of emirates there. Dubai is one of the emirates: Sharjah, Ajman, Ras Al Khaimah, Abu Dhabi, Umm Al Quwain, Fujairah. These are the other emirates. And I've lived in Dubai. I visited the others from time to time. I lived in Dubai. I've spent part of my childhood there. And yes, it is. Most of the Arab countries, the Gulf countries there, essentially are a racial hierarchy. And they are what I like to think of as racist in the truest sense of the word.
Not in the politically correct sense. You say in the true sense.
Right. See, what we do on one of the things we do on our website is we try to bifurcate the meanings of racism. So there is the meaning, there is the common, the common perception of racism in modern society. But what that really is it's basically just xenophobia. But racism, I mean, if you go down to the ideological roots of racism, per se, in the early 19th century and such, it is basically this belief that human beings can be graded on the basis of race. They can be ranked on the basis of race. You can grade the worth of a person based on their race, and that's essentially what they do in Dubai. So in not just in Dubai, but in the in some of the other Gulf Arab states as well, so Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Kuwait, and none of these, they aren't any different really. So essentially what you see here is they literally believe that they're on top, and then below them you've got Europeans, white people, Western Europeans, North Americans, and then below them you've got your expat Arabs. And, right at the bottom, you've got Eurasians. But even among Asians, there's another hierarchy there as well. You've got Filipinos, and you've got Indians, and then, you've got Pakistanis and Bangladeshis at the very bottom. So these societies are racist in the truest sense of the word, whereas in the West, what's referred to as racism is essentially just xenophobia. So we try to make that very clear on our website. A certain amount of xenophobia is essentially it's necessary. A small amount of xenophobia obviously is necessary to maintain group cohesion in any society, is what we believe. Yeah.
And I'm in Southern California, so this environment is one of the most extremely diverse, but also one of the most extremely politically correct environments.
Right. I used to live in Toronto, and it's not very different there. Very liberal city. And I went to university there. And so I've lived in such an environment. And I was fairly liberal in the old days, but that gradually changed over time. With the passage of time, I began to move slowly towards the right. And I came to this realization when I actually moved back to Dubai briefly in the mid-2000s. And I began applying for jobs, and I began to actually see the racial hierarchy very clearly. And then I began to realize what I what I'd left behind in Canada. And then I realized again that, Canadian society is, Canadian society, North America, the societies of the U.S. and Canada are what they are due to their values, their underlying foundational values. And you don't really see that until you actually leave these societies and live in a culture whose values are complete, diametrically opposed to the values of North America, the West in general.
And what part of India is your background from?
I was born in Bombay, in Mumbai. But my ancestry goes back to Gujarat. So culturally, I am a Gujarati.
And are you, you're from a Muslim background?
Yes, that's correct. Specifically Shia.
Are you practicing Muslim, or are you pretty secular?
I don't practice much. No, actually, I don't practice at all, as a matter of fact. I used to. During my early 20s, I was fairly religious. But, with time, again, I began to, lose my religion in some ways. It's actually, it's strange, actually, because during my early 20s, I was in some ways very liberal, but when it came to religious issues and religious matters, I was still fairly conservative, fairly, fairly right-wing. So, and it's funny because I never really saw an overlap between the two. I kept my religion quite separate from my political beliefs. So, but that changed in time. With time, I began to drift away from mainstream, from Islam in general.
Was that when you were living in Dubai?
I would say the process did begin there. And over the past 4 years or so, I essentially just moved away from practicing Islam.
I know you've written a little bit about Islam on your website. What is that article? You had an article. Is it Dota versus the House Muslims? What was that? What was the specific context? And what do you mean by that when you say the House Muslims?
The House Muslims are the likes of, say, Salim Mansour and Tariq Fatah and these chaps. Basically, what they do is they bash Islam, but they do so from a very liberal point of view. They do so from they come in from a very liberal angle.
Yeah, like from saying that the extreme elements of Islam are anti-feminist, homophobic, or anti-Israel in that regard. Like, is that what you mean?
Pretty much. They're coming in quite strongly from, they're coming in from a strong liberal angle, and that's pretty much what I'm opposed to, because the way I see it, liberalism and all of its pet causes, such as feminism, mass immigration, and such, these are essentially, they serve an elitist agenda. They don't serve our interests as the people, they serve the interests of the elites, far elites specifically. And what these Muslims do is, on one hand, they pretend to relate to average Canadians, but on the other hand, they're essentially, pushing for a liberal agenda. And that's why I refer to them as House Muslims, because they're essentially fighting for an elitist agenda. North American culture is traditionally conservative. It is. And but these individuals insist that it's liberal, which is entirely bogus. If they were to come and live here and visit the prairies, the culture here is extremely conservative. It's only liberal in cities such as Toronto and Vancouver, cities on the coast. But Canada is still fairly conservative. And these people seem to pretend that conservative culture simply does not exist. Now, if they truly were speaking for Canadians, then they would, adopt a more conservative stance. But they seem to speak on behalf of liberal issues such as feminism and multiculturalism. Multiculturalism is, of course, a very thorny issue here in Canada. On the surface of it, Canadians seem to like it very much. But then, when you actually go out and speak to people and interact with them, they obviously don't appreciate their countries being invaded by a horde of aliens who have values that are, quite different from theirs, diametrically opposed to theirs.
Would you say there are differences between the anti-Muslim movements in Europe and anti-Muslim movements in the United States?
That's an interesting question. In some ways, I see where they're coming from. And I've written about this as well briefly. It's one of the issues why a lot of these individuals focus on Muslims as a group is because, for starters, I think Muslims are a highly artificial group. I mean, they shouldn't. When I hear the term Muslims, I honestly don't know what to make of it because there's so many various races and ethnicities that, you know, practice. I mean, Muslims come from various ethnic and racial backgrounds. So when people use the term Muslims, I'm not really sure what they really mean. And essentially, in the West and even in Europe, what they've done is Muslim has become an ethnicity. Muslims have been treated as an ethnicity, which is bogus, I think.
I think part of it is that in some ways it's more politically correct to complain about Muslims than to talk about, non-white immigration in general. I think in some ways it's a semi-politically correct euphemism.
True enough, but I think there's more to this. And I think personally, and this is just my opinion here, is that I think Muslim immigration is difficult to manage. Especially with regards to organized jury, it can be quite problematic because Muslims are quite, well, they are anti-Semitic.
and you say that was true? When you lived among the Arabs in Dubai, would you say that they were very anti-Jewish?
They certainly were. I remember, and it's interesting you asked this because I remember an anecdote from high school where, the term Yahudi, which is actually Hebrew and Arabic for Jew, was a swear word. And interestingly enough, I didn't know what the word Yahudi meant. So I remember going and asking my dad. So I asked my old man, and he simply told me that Yahudi simply meant Jew. And then I asked him that, what, you know, who are the Jews? What's a Jew? You know, what's a Jew? And he said, there are people. So yes, it is. Yes, Arabs are fiercely anti-Jewish. There's no doubt there. But I think that with an increase of Muslim immigration here in the West, this would probably go against the agenda of organized jury. These people would be difficult to manage. On one hand, it would be easy to create a heterogeneous and an atomized society which jury can easily lord over. But then it would be much harder to actually control a society with minorities that are actively hostile towards Jewish interests. So that might be one. So I think, in my view, this is essentially a case of organized jury trying to have their own cake and eat it too. You know, on one hand, yes, they do want immigration to come in so they can subvert North America's white ethnic character. But on the other hand, they also want to keep Muslims out who might challenge their power. And that's just my point of view. That's what I think.
And I know you've written about the movies. You've done some reviews of Hollywood movies. Like Happy Gilmore and High School High, and the Longest Yard, the Adam Sandler movie. Well, there was original Longest Yard, but there's an Adam Sandler version where Adam Sandler plays an NFL star who goes to prison.
Yeah, basically, the reason I reviewed those films was essentially to show you the Jewish character of Hollywood. When you watch those films, they share a common characteristic, and that is essentially rebellion. So, you've got, and of course, the rebellion is led by a Jew. He leads a rebellion of usually black people against the power structure, the existing power structure, which is always usually white and Anglo-Saxon at that. You see that in High School High. You see that in Happy Gilmore.
So High School High is the one. John Lovitz is the teacher, and he goes to teach in the ghetto. And he has John Lovitz has a rebellion against the principal. And then in the prison movie, The Longest Yard, Adam Sandler, he leads the inmates against the warden.
Pretty much, yes. Rebellion is essentially an interesting characteristic of Judaism, really. Christianity is about submission to God's will in some ways. And Islam essentially borrows that aspect of Christianity and then kind of melds it into its own theology, into its own theological framework. Islam actually means submission. It's the Arabic word for submission. Judaism seems to be more about rebellion, and you see the theme of rebellion pop up in the Old Testament from time to time. And when you watch these Hollywood movies, that's essentially what you see. You know, you see this theme of rebellion that keeps coming up, and it's essentially a rebellion of Jews rebelling against, you know, the local, the existing power structure. And it's very interesting. So I'd written about that some time ago, and I think this is essentially at its core, I think in some ways this is essentially a very communist way of looking at things. Especially in High School High, there's a very interesting scene where the they were planting trees, you know, planting trees in the schoolyard or something of the sort. It was a very brief scene, but that strikes me in some ways. Now, I know it's I mean, when people watch the scene, it seems fairly harmless, but what it really is there's these communist undertones. You know, you've got rebellion, and then you've got people working together shoulder to shoulder, and then you've got the elite power structure, you know, that watches them with hostile malevolence. And you've got this. That's essentially a very Jewish characteristic, and that's the Jewish character of Hollywood that I was talking about in the film. I mean, in my post.
So you're saying that, and they sort of in the movies they're always like the underdog. They don't present themselves as an elite.
Pretty much, yes. The Jews see themselves as leading these underdogs, of course, and naturally, when you watch the movies, the Jewishness of the characters or the protagonists are obviously muted for good reason. But Judaism has always been had this streak of rebelliousness, especially when you look at their involvement in things like feminism and pornography and things like that. Especially feminism is interesting as well. This is basically a rebellion of, you know, women against men, patriarchy, multiculturalism. Essentially a rebellion of minorities against the majority, you know, gay marriage, rebellion against family, and so on and so forth. Porn is obviously a rebellion against religion and such. So Jews have always been at the forefront, you know, leading these rebellions, which are essentially attempts at subverting Western culture. And you really do see this in Hollywood movies from time to time.
And you also reviewed a movie called, I have not seen this movie yet, but I've heard of it. It's a comedy called Outsourced, and it's about a white American guy who, he loses his job, and he has to go, he travels to India, and he trains people in one of those call centers in India.
Yes, that was the movie I'd seen recently, actually. I know it's, I think it came out in, it was released in 2009, but it's a movie I'd seen recently. It's a very interesting movie, actually. What you see is, you know, you see a man who's thrust into a hostile environment. Not really a hostile environment, but an environment that's completely alien. And he stands out due to his values, you know. He believes in individualism, you know, and, you know, inequality and those, and, you know, that sort of thing. And he stands out in a culture that... he stands out in a culture where these values would be perceived as being completely alien. And I know the movie wasn't really a white nationalist movie or anything of the sort, but when you watch the movie, you get a sense of just how unique, you know, Western culture is, because it produces individuals that are unique. I mean, in the sense, it produces a better individual. Western civilization's emphasis has always been about producing a better individual. Whereas other civilizations, you know, they focus more on more top-down approach, specifically on hierarchy and order and such. Whereas in Western civilization, the ethics, the emphasis is on actually creating a better individual. And you see that in the movie, you know, when you see the way he interacts with individuals, with other individuals, especially the way he manages his call center. And I found that to be very interesting, because he asks his subordinates for their opinions, for their views. I mean, initially it seems that he's imposing his own way of doing things, you know, he's imposing his own management style. But in time he understands that, you know, that won't work here, and then he begins a more democratic process. And you see that, and that's very interesting, because India is a very authoritarian country. You're not on a first-name basis with your boss in India, for the most part, anyhow. You always refer to them as Sir or Mr. and the first name. It's a bit of a strange custom, but that's pretty much what you say. But here, he seems to be equal. You know, he's not lording over them. He is their equal. He is the manager, yes, but he's also their equal, and he addresses them as such. So
It's probably the same way in country places like Dubai as well.
It is, yes, it is exactly the same in places like Dubai. Your manager clearly has power over you, not just coercive power, but you know, they have certain rank, a certain status. In these cultures, you're supposed to respect your managers. Obviously, not everyone does. Most people don't. But you certainly cannot be on a first name basis with you. I mean, I never was when I worked in Dubai. I was never on a first name basis with my managers. It was always either Sir, Ma'am, or Mr. and their first name. And that's how it was. But in the West, of course, there is a certain equality between managers and their subordinates. It's very interesting. And you see that essentially, because this is essentially, and even when you actually analyze South Asian languages, specifically say Hindi or Gujarati as such, you know, you've got all these honorifics. And the whole point of honorifics is essentially to determine the status of the speaker. And Western languages, in contrast, are flat. You know, so this notion of hierarchy is actually built right into South Asian languages. So that's very interesting. So when you compare English to, say, Hindi as such, you know, English and many European languages, of course, I think Spanish should be an exception here. There are honorifics in Spanish, from what I understand. But when you look at English and say some of these other Western European languages, it'd be more flat because the function of these languages is to communicate information.
If you follow the Robert Lindsay blog, he's always bashing India. What is your take on his criticisms of India and how accurate are they?
Robert Lindsay assumes a more socialist. He assumes a more socialist approach when he critiques India as such. He hates the inequality, you know, the inequality which is embedded in Indian culture. And I feel that some of his criticisms are valid. But initially he believed, and I think he was wrong in this regard. He seemed to think that a lot of India's problems stem from capitalism, but that's not really the case. A lot of India's problems are cultural. There are resources available, but it's just that the resources are very unevenly distributed. And a lot of India's issues, as I mentioned before, are basically cultural. For example, education. India's had a very hard time overcoming illiteracy. And one of the reasons for this is because historically, you know, the lower castes were forbidden to learn, you know, they were forbidden in education. And there's some very interesting stories also in ancient Indian mythology about this, about talented individuals from the lower castes being denied an opportunity to better themselves. You know, the story of Eklavya and Dronacharya from the Mahabharata immediately comes to mind, where a lower caste archer is denied training because he comes from a lower caste. So a lot of these issues, it's not just about, yes, there are a lot of people, no doubt, and that is a challenge. But the resources and the political will, there is no political will. When people talk about India, specifically Western pundits, they'll always say that there is no political will. There's a lack of political will. And that's true. Yes, it's true that the government is fairly indifferent to the suffering of its people. But a lot of that is basically a reflection of the attitudes of, you know, society at large. Society is to blame. But that's not something they're going to get into because if they would get into that, then, you know, there'd be other issues, you know, you'd have to open Pandora's box, criticize Indian culture and all of that sort of thing. And those are issues they want to avoid. So, yes, I do think population is an issue, but it's an issue that can be overcome. I mean, it's a challenge. It's a hurdle that can easily be overcome. You know, there are resources in the country. I mean, just look at the Ambanis. I mean, let's look at Indian industrialists, for example, the Ambanis, for example, you know. There's virtually none of our industrialists are philanthropists. So, I mean, the Indian journalist R.K.R. Patel has written extensively about this, that there's very little philanthropy going on in India. You know, I mean, one of India's greatest philanthropists is Tata.
And I know a Bay Area guy. I'll discuss this more in detail when I interview him. But I guess briefly, you saw that article that he wrote about how he didn't use the word capitalism, but he said how corporations are responsible for a lot of the cultural declines of society.
He's right, yes. But he's referring to corporate greed specifically. And he's referring to a specific class in North American society, specifically in American society. Well, they exist in Canada too, but specifically in American society, the corporate class. You know, they have no real loyalty towards anyone. See, I'm for capitalism too. You know, I mean, I see myself as a paleoconservative, and I identify as a paleoconservative, and I see I am for capitalism, but I'm actually for smaller businesses, which the U.S. is indifferent.
So small scale capitalism as opposed to big capital.
If you look at the economy of the U.S. somewhere before and after World War II, like the 40s and 50s and such, you had, you know, it was in some ways a fairly informal kind of economy. You've got these mom and pop stores and things. And then obviously those were edged out. And then you had Walmart and the big box retailers come in. And while supply, and obviously with Walmart, you know, you've got a very, the U.S. economy has a very efficient supply chain thing going on, right? You know, you've got Walmart and the big box retailers and such. But in the old days, the 40s and, you know, before, somewhere around that area, somewhere around that period of time, there were a lot of small businesses, and, you know, a lot of Americans, a large percentage of the population was self-employed. That's the capitalism that I'm in. That's the capitalism that I stand in favor of. And, you know, capitalism where people run their own operations and they're self-employed. So what we're seeing today is basically corporatism. You know, you've seen the rise of the corporation. The corporation has become a class. And you, when you talk to Bay Area guy, he'll reiterate some of these points. You know, the corporations have no loyalty to the society they serve, whereas traditionally we believe that business should serve society. That's the whole point. For corporations seek to serve themselves at the expense of society.
Back to the topic of India, well, you've wrote in an article about the Hindu nationalist movement. You talk about their alliance with Israel and Zionism.
I have written about it. I had written an article about it, and I think that theirs is not simply an alliance of convenience. It's much deeper than that. It's much more than that. They share certain views in common. Their values are, you know, I mean, their core values are in some ways just mirror images of one another. So you've got Zionists, essentially, that represents the worst aspect of Jewry, you know, the supremacy and looking down on Gentiles and that sort of thing. And then Hindutva is essentially, Hindu nationalism, is basically an ideology that represents the supremacy of the Brahmin. When the British left, you know, the Brahmins had to step in and take control of.
So you're not a Brahmin.
No, I'm not actually. I was born into the Bohra community. It's a small mercantile community originally from Gujarat, that basically from the trader caste that converted to Islam somewhere around the 12th century. Essentially, what the Brahmins wanted to do is they believe in their own supremacy, and Hindutva is essentially an attempt at them exerting cultural influence, you know, cultural dominance, in the absence of the British. The British have left, and the British were obviously a huge threat to them. And so that's basically what Hindutva is. Now, Hindutva also, you know, Brahminism is basically a belief in Brahmin superiority. It's essentially a very supremacist ideology. And if you look at the structure of, say, the RSS, which is the mother organization of Hindu nationalism in India, you've got the ones on the top are basically Brahmins. And then, you know,
but under capitalism, doesn't capitalism say the merchant class in India was called the vice? Is that the vice? Yes. So wouldn't capitalism put the merchant class on the top?
It's not about wealth. It's not about controlling wealth in India. The Brahmins had a certain privilege, a certain status, and they were the ones that suffered an acute loss of privilege every time India was invaded by, say, the Muslims or the British, because they obviously wouldn't. They obviously didn't buy Brahmin supremacy. I mean, the other castes of India were not affected as much. So the Vaish caste, which is originally my caste, continued to trade. The peasants continued to live off land. Even the aristocracy, they continued to rule as puppets, probably, but they essentially still continued to, you know, serve in their capacity, you know, in the same capacity, that is. So the only ones who actually suffer a loss of privilege were the Brahmins. And Hindutva is essentially an attempt at the Brahmins sort of exerting that influence. So now, traditionally, yes, the Vaish control more, the Vaish control wealth. And with capitalism, especially in India today, you'll notice that some of the major industrialists in India are essentially from the mercantile castes. And you'll see that even among the Muslims, even if you look at Pakistan today, a lot of, you know, if you look at Karachi's economy, the stock exchange there is dominated by Muslims who are converted from the Vaish caste. So Pakistan isn't immune to caste either. Now, if you look at the Bohras, the Maimans, the Ismaili Khojas, these individuals dominate Pakistan's economy. They dominate Pakistan's, Karachi's stock exchange. So Pakistan isn't entirely immune from caste as well. And, so yes, it's true that capitalism did favor the Vaish caste, but not in terms of status primarily. You know, they just gave them the means to accumulate even more wealth, but they never really did use that wealth for the betterment of society.
Because obviously, if you look at America, I mean, the ruling class in America are obviously, they are the merchant class.
America is interesting. You could call them the merchant. Yes, you could say you could call them the merchant class, I suppose. And that's, I suppose, part of the problem in some ways, because even Adam Smith was actually against the merchant class and its alliance with the government, the states.
Yeah, I mean, he basically said that was the most dangerous thing, And he's the father of capitalism, but he warned against allowing the merchant class to be the ruling class.
Exactly. But see, Smith had a very interesting idea, though. He was, in some ways, a liberal, in the sense, a classical liberal, in the same tradition as, say, Hobbes and John Locke. And the reason I say this is because, to him, capitalism was essentially shifting capital away from this parasitic merchant class to the people, so that people will have the means to fend for themselves. People should have access to the factors of production. And that was essentially where he was coming from. So in some ways, now we associate Adam Smith with the right, but I suspect he, in his own day, he might have been associated with classical liberals. But yes, he did oppose the merchant class and their association with the aristocracy.
We were discussing the alliance between Zionism and the Hindu nationalist movement.
Right. So, back to the topic. Yes, they do share certain views and comments, such as elitism, which also includes a disdain for manual labor. When you see that among Jews, Jews think that manual labor is essentially for the goyim, the donkeys. And in India, there's this disdain for manual labor too, which you see in Indian society. In India, India does not have the same work ethic as does the West. The Protestant work ethic that views all work as inherently dignified. So there certainly are similarities, and obviously there's also their hatred for Islam as well. But I think that's in some ways just their. That's something that's very apparent. But in many ways, they've got similar values, similar work ethic, similar attitude also towards the divine, as I'd mentioned before. You'd see Judaism is in some ways a very classical Judaism, anyhow, is a very transactional faith. You do this, and you keep God's laws, and then God gives you a reward. Well, and the reward is actually worldly, land, descendants.
So as opposed to in Christianity and Islam, it's mostly heaven is a reward.
Heaven is a reward, and goodness, acts of charity is essentially a reward in its own self, in its own right. That's essentially the Christian and Islamic view. I mean, Muhammad was smart enough when Islam came into being, when Muhammad crafted his religion, he was quite smart to, incorporate some of the more universal elements of Christianity into his religious framework. And but Judaism, of course, in some ways, is actually a very transactional religion, as is Hinduism. When you practice, as far as mainstream Hinduism is concerned, anyhow, the way it's practiced, yes, it's very transactional. You go to temples, you give your money, you donate your money to the gods, and you'll see Hindus do this all the time, and hopefully you can buy some divine favors this way. That money is never really spent on feeding the poor or educating the illiterate, but that's why, you'll have some Hindutva apologists say that, well, the money in temples is used to, feed the poor for charity and all that such and all that stuff. But in reality, I really don't think so. I mean, if you look at that temple in South India, Tirupati, I think it was called, they found a chamber and there was so much of wealth. There was so much of wealth, and the priests were unaware of its existence. Now, if this money was used historically to feed the poor and such, how could you misplace it? The fact is that it wasn't used charitably, and this idea must have been, and the idea of using money, using wealth to better society is essentially a Western one. So you've got this transactional view, this transactional relationship with the divine, which you see in Hinduism and Judaism as well. And then, of course, there are other elements like hyperfascism. There's this hatred of the other, Israel is, of course, and for all intents and purposes, a fascist country. And Hindutva is, of course, basically Hindu fascism.
Yeah, and what's ironic, as you pointed this out, is during the British occupation, a lot of those people were pro Hitler.
Yes, they were. And it's funny, and what's even more ironic is that the Zionists are actually aware of this, but it really makes no difference.
But they are willing to look the
other
way.
Yes, they are. They are willing to look the other way. They're quite aware.
Yet when it comes to the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem meeting with Hitler, that is a really big deal.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the Zionists are quite aware of, of Hindutva's propensity to praise and not really exonerate, but praise Hitler and, well, look up to Hitler and such. There's certain aspects of Hitler that that resonates with the Indian psyche, and that is, well, one of them is that he was very authoritarian and he was a charismatic leader. And Indians like authoritarian and charismatic leaders, which is one of the reasons why Narendra Modi is so popular in India. And he's the BJP's major prime ministerial candidate, and so they are willing to look the other way, and it really makes no difference to them.
I'm looking at your article, Deconstructing the Screed of a Young Third-Generation Feminist.
Yeah.
And you've written about the feminist issue is a fairly significant article on the blog.
So feminism is something we touch upon quite often on the blog. We believe, both me and Beira Guy actually believe, that feminism is essentially an attempt of... It's one of the most subversive influences on Western society. It threatens religion, ethnicity in some ways, but mostly religion and culture. And it threatens the patriarchal nature of our societies. And we believe that all healthy societies are essentially patriarchal because historically men have always served as the architects of civilization. And we do discuss feminism quite a bit and, you know, some of their modes of reasoning. And feminists reason in a certain way. I refer to it as not just feminists, but liberals in general. These postmodernist deconstructionist types, they tend to reason a certain way, which I refer to as the dialectical form of reasoning. You know, the term, this mode of argument, this argument actually goes back, or this type of argument goes back to the Greek philosopher Zeno. And he articulates it in his three paradoxes. Essentially, the purpose of this type of argument is to lead a seemingly sound premise and demonstrate it to be false by demonstrating that it can, that these premises lead to conclusions that are unsound. And that's kind of what feminists do. So they'll say one of the major tenets of feminist doctrine is that gender roles are socially constructed. And we know this is incorrect.
So it's the same as cultural Marxism teaches, that gender and race are both social constructs.
Exactly, yes. Cultural Marxism does insist that these things are social constructs, gender is. But the way feminists argue this is that when they say that gender is a social construct, or that masculinity and femininity are social constructs, they argue as follows, though. They'll say that, how can there be one objective truth? Because if you look at the way Europeans would think, the European intellectual class thought in the 18th and early 19th centuries, it was essentially a very positivistic approach to knowledge, essentially that there is objective truth. Objective truth exists. The problem with our culture is that we believe that objective truth does not exist. That's essentially postmodernism, and that's the postmodernist approach to, well, culture and whatever. So feminists argue in the same way. They argue that, say, gender roles do not exist, and if you look at various other cultures, masculinity and femininity are expressed in different ways. So how can there be an objective truth, you know, in the face of such pluralism? That's basically their way of arguing. Now, if I were to parody this mode of thinking, I could come up with the following analogy. I could say that let's assume there is an object in a room. It's asymmetrical and it's in the center of the room. Now, as you circle the object, it changes form. Now, if I were to use liberal logic here, I would argue that just because it changes form, it has no consistent form, and so the object itself does not exist. Now, I know this is a bit of an extreme and ridiculous example, but that's liberal thinking for you. Whereas I would argue and say that the object does exist. Even if its form might be inconsistent, it has certain properties that cannot, you know, that are not altered, that cannot be altered, such as its height, its weight, you know, its volume. So if I were to address this idea that gender roles are socially constructed, I would use the following argument. I'd say that, yes, it's true that different cultures express masculinity and femininity in different ways. However, it doesn't change the fact that in all major civilizations, men have always served as the architects of civilization. They always have, and hopefully.
And a feminist will say that is because men were oppressing women and not giving them the opportunity to be architects of civilization.
See, this is completely incorrect. And there was a very interesting comment made on Robert Lindsay's blog by one of his commenters, and he had said that if you compare the intellectual output of Catholic monks with nuns during the Middle Ages, I mean, Catholic monks were instrumental in they were responsible for a significant amount of intellectual output during the Middle Ages. They maintained libraries, wrote commentaries, translated texts, and so on and so forth. And they helped in, you know, creating the cultural infrastructure that would eventually lead to, you know, the Renaissance and the Enlightenment and so on. But in comparison, what was the contribution of Catholic nuns during that time? You know, you can't say that they were oppressed or that, you know, childbearing and domestic responsibilities got in the way. It didn't apply. So what's the deal? And as I've also demonstrated on my website, historically, women have always been the guardians of patriarchy. Because women instinctively understood that patriarchy was also good for women. It allowed women to be women. You know, and because women really need to trust. And so patriarchy gives them that safer environment where women can actually be women. I mean, if you look at India, if you read up on some of the honor killings, a lot of honor killings are actually committed by women against other women. Not just by women.
And you never hear that in the media. Really, most people have no idea.
Exactly.
That.
You know, I mean, you have mothers killing their daughters and for the sake of family honor. I mean, they don't do it on their, they don't do it themselves. They don't do it exclusively themselves. I mean, they.
And this is in Hinduism. It's not just Islam. Hinduism.
Exactly.
As well.
Yes. It's in Hinduism as well. It's basically just a South Asian thing. And if you look at some of these honor killings that take place among Hindus and Muslims or whatever the religion is in India, you'll notice that the one thing these killings have in common is that they're committed by certain castes in India, specifically the trader, sorry, not the trader, the peasant and the warrior castes that actually prize honor. And secondly, women participate in honor killings. And you'll see this. And even historically, there are examples of this, you know, where women will attack other women and accuse them of whatnot, knowing fully well that, you know, their accusations could lead to an honor killing. There was an example of this in Islamic history, as a matter of fact, when one of the prophet's wives, Aisha, was accused of adultery. One of the individuals who made the accusation was a woman. She was the sister of one of Muhammad's other wives, Zainab bin Jash. And so she knew fully well that the accusation might lead to, you know, to Aisha's execution. But so, yes, it's true. Women have always been, you know, the guardians of patriarchy in traditional cultures, which means that women have always been conservative. What we see in the West here is a reversal of that. Now women have become very liberal, and it's men, in some ways, that are the only ones bothered about preserving Western culture. I mean, you look at white nationalism, for example, in the U.S., or, you know, any of these white preservationist movements, they're mostly dominated by men. There are no women.
Yeah, 90% male or even more.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Would you use that term white nationalist to describe yourself?
I don't really see myself as a white nationalist. White nationalism is, well, obviously I'm not white, but that being said, white nationalism is global in scope. White nationalists are concerned with the plight of whites all across, you know, all over the world. Whereas and of course there's also a very strong emphasis on HPD, which is something I really don't care much about. I don't care about it at all. As a matter of fact, I'm quite indifferent to HPD. I care about culture, and that's what I write about. And in order to preserve Western culture, you need to preserve white people. It's as simple as that. So I do favor a strong white majority in Canada and the U.S., because what happens down there affects us up here. So I do advocate for a strong white majority state, which means I'm all...
And here in Southern California, that's obviously... California as a whole, that's not the case.
Well, yes, that is very unfortunate. It's the same in places like Toronto and Vancouver, which are extremely liberal cities. But the way I see it, though, is that to preserve Western culture, to preserve a healthy society, we need to preserve the ethnic character of North American society. Every society is essentially defined along ethnic lines. And the same goes for individuals. You know, when I look in the mirror, what do I see, right? The color of the skin, the color of my skin is the very first thing I see. I cannot see my religion. I cannot see my caste or anything of, you know, any of these other things. I see my race. I mean, that's the first, and that's how societies have historically defined themselves. You know, it goes all the way back to the ancient Greeks, the Arabs. I mean, Xenophanes, for example, you know, he had traveled to Ethiopia and other parts of Europe, and he has these detailed descriptions of the physical characteristics of the other people, the, you know, the non-Greeks that he encountered. And so it's normal and it's healthy for a society to define itself along ethnic lines. But Western countries are obviously not allowed to do this. And much of that has to do with, obviously, cultural Marxism, which is now being, you know, peddled in schools and in universities. I mean, when you go to universities, you're, you know, this is essentially the approach to history, the approach to culture that they push down your throat, the cultural Marxist approach.
What are your biggest criticisms of white nationalism?
They seem to be fairly disorganized. The movement consists primarily of keyboard warriors. So these are individuals that it's a very disorganized movement for the most part, right? I mean, when I, for example, when I engage other people, when I here in Saskatoon, it's easy to find white people that are fairly conservative, men and women alike. So I engage them, I talk to them about these issues and such. Sometimes I'm obviously called racist or xenophobic or whatever, but for the most part.
So even you're being from a non-European background, that doesn't immune you from these charges.
Oh no, absolutely not. The charges aren't leveled. The charges aren't leveled with the same intensity as they would to, say, a European or someone of European descent, you know. But who would make?
But there's still, it's not as harsh. But they're like, "What's wrong with you, man?"
That's essentially the reaction I get for the most part. People just look at me and wonder what's wrong with you.
They think you're a weirdo, or
yes, they think it's strange. They think that I want to be white. And if I could wave a magic wand, you know, I'd turn myself into a white person or something of the sort. And I'm accused of being self-hating and a lot of things. But the way I see it, I'm only doing this for Canada. If Canada is to remain a healthy society, it should learn to embrace its European heritage. It's really as simple as that. I mean, if you were to go to India, you know, and if you were on a bus and you were to say India Pride, Indian Pride or something of the sort, it's okay. You know, nobody would... Well, obviously, some people would be disturbed by the commotion, but nobody would really care. Now, if you were to say white pride in a public, you know, in a public place, in a public space or something of the sort, you know, you're in trouble. You're asking for it. So
it's almost more socially acceptable to have sex in public than to do that.
Yeah, you could say that for sure. So basically, Bill, back to white nationalism. Problem is, it seems to be very disorganized. I don't think they can agree on a lot of issues. Well, they agree on some issues, but... there's no real manifesto of sorts, and it's not a very coherent movement. And of course, there's this emphasis on HBD, which is, I think, a little ridiculous. But I mean, it's not that I have anything against HBD. It's fine. I mean, it is a legitimate field of inquiry, I suppose. But I focus more on culture. That's my take. And I think white nationalism should focus on Western culture. And specifically within, focus on preserving the ethnic character of their own societies, rather than turning this into some sort of global movement. You know, a lot of white nationalists are concerned about the plight of white people in Europe.
Well, that's an American phenomenon. I think in Europe, there is a healthy sense of sort of local culture and local history. But because Americans, I think the problem is Americans and Canadians to a degree, they lack the sense of culture, and a lot of Americans, other than pop culture, they basically have nothing, so they have to rely exclusively on race.
You could say that, yes, but for all intents and purposes, and this is something a commenter of mine pointed out once on the website, that in North America, race, I mean, whites, for all intents and purposes, are an ethnicity. They're seen as an ethnicity, and they're treated as an ethnicity. So they are an ethnicity, and there's nothing wrong in defining our society, you know, calling ourselves a white country, calling Canada a white country, calling the U.S. a white country. So I don't see an issue there. But yes, you're right. Of course, when you go to Europe, you know, the nationalism is more regional. But here in North America, of course, it's a different story because, and of course, a lot of people are of mixed heritage, you know, as well.
And people probably say to you is, if those people were to take power, the first thing they do is they would kick you out. Do you get that?
I do get that quite a lot. I do get that quite a bit. But see, this is my perspective on things. I think we need to slow down immigration, slow it down considerably. As far as Canada is concerned, Canada should be 90% white. 85, okay, fine, I can live at 85 as well.
Well, California, it's now down, I think it's 38%.
See, that's really unfortunate. And I think, in my view, that the U.S., I mean, at least Canada, should be 90% white. And to do this, of course, we need to very carefully monitor immigration. So as soon as, if whites drop to say 89% or say 85% or something, then it's time to slow immigration down again. And it's not practical, it's not feasible to completely shut immigration down. You know, completely shut down immigration, I don't think that's going to happen, but we can at least monitor it to ensure that whites are a healthy majority in Canada and in the U.S. I'm not talking about deporting non-white people or anything of the sort. I don't think so. I mean, that's never been my view, but we can limit immigration. And there should be an emphasis on getting immigrants to assimilate into Canadian culture rather than simply maintain their own ethnic bubbles and, you know, which is euphemistically called multiculturalism, which I think is bogus, but that's basically my view, that we need to stop him and we need to curb immigration and ensure that non-white immigrants assimilate into Western culture to the best of their abilities, of course.
What are your thoughts on the South Asian community in Canada and the West?
They are very successful, economically speaking, because a lot of the individuals that actually migrate to the West, to the U.S. and to Canada are people from the upper castes. Well, with the exception of the Patels, I guess, who are technically a peasant caste, the peasant caste of Gujarat. But many of these individuals, especially the ones you see in Silicon Valley and such, a lot of these individuals are Brahmins. And as such, because they're from the upper castes, you know, they tend to be very successful. They're privileged. I mean, I know liberals don't see them as privileged, you know, because they're not white and, you know, they have to contend with white privilege and all that. But for all intents and purposes, they're actually quite privileged. In fact, they're more privileged than a lot of Americans would be, a lot of native-born Americans. You know, I mean, for example, they're certainly more privileged than, say, black Americans, African Americans. You know, they command high levels of disposable income, among other things. But they're essentially from the upper castes.
Yeah, they are. I think if you look at statistics by the wealthiest religious sects, I think Hinduism is second to Judaism as the wealthiest religious sect.
That's true. They are fairly wealthy, but a lot of these individuals are from the upper castes. But they're also very tribal. And you can see this now. You're seeing the formation of this Hindu lobby, proto-Hindu lobby of sorts. And they seem to have learned quite a bit from their Zionist allies. You know, they're trying to provoke, you know, hostile relations with Pakistan, you know, with the U.S. and Pakistan and that sort of thing. And a lot of Indians seem to be quite okay with this, you know, lobbying. And but whom are they lobbying for, essentially? They're lobbying for India's interests. And I mean, I know that sounds a little extreme.
So it's kind of like the AIPAC Israel lobby.
Yeah, but
not as influential, not but kind of doing copying.
Yeah, not even close to being as influential, but they're certainly...
So maybe they could be 40 years, 30 years from now. Who knows?
It's possible. They do have a lot of wealth. It's possible, but they're essentially very tribal. And you see that, you know, you see the way they copy the Jewish lobby and, you know, and things. And in time they will exercise more power, I'm fairly sure. I mean, there was a California textbook controversy, I think, some years ago, where the Hindutvas were trying to rewrite the content of textbooks, of American textbooks pertaining to Indian history. I mean, there were some factual inaccuracies, yes, but then they were trying to rewrite it with a whitewashed version of India's history. And there was a pretty big outcry from the academic community. And I'm not exactly sure what happened with the issue and how it ended. What I'm trying to point out is that as they gain power, yes, they will begin to exercise their power and their influence. It's only natural, I suppose.
So before I wrap up the show, is there anything else you'd like to add?
I'd like to add that Western culture is worth preserving, and take that for what it's worth, coming from a South Asian man. And there's of course many ways of doing it, but the most important way of doing it is for white people to embrace their own identities. And this won't necessarily lead to fascism or anything of the sort. In fact, it might actually work as as a counteragent to xenophobia, because every society needs a healthy expression of nationalism. You know, suppress nationalism. I've said this before, but nationalism is in some ways like sex. You know, you can't suppress it.
I think if you suppress sex, it comes out in extreme forms. I think if you suppress nationalism, it comes out in the most extreme forms.
Exactly, and I think, and it's funny because, you know, when you look at xenophobia in the U.S., a lot of it is just basically frustration. It's the frustration of whites It's their frustration at the, you know, at their inability to embrace their own heritage.
And it's a natural sense of frustration.
Oh yeah, it really is. But then liberals will claim that, look at this, you know, white people are all racist at the core, and we need more multiculturalism and more liberalism to, you know, curb their destructive.
You have to reprogram their way of thinking.
Precisely, but they don't seem to realize that they're actually part of the problem. And that's, and I think, and as strange as this sounds, and this might be a bit of a paradox, but with the rise of white nationalism in the U.S., which, and I don't mean to sound pessimistic, but I don't see it happening anytime soon, but let's just say that white nationalism begins to gain ground in the U.S. and Canada, I actually think that xenophobia would go down. Initially, there might be an initial spike of xenophobia for sure, but in time, I think it would actually go down. The levels lower than the ones we experience today.
Yeah, I agree. I don't know about the. I think in Europe, I see those kind of movements rising, but the United States, I don't know. I don't see it as. Who knows? I mean, it could happen, but I think it's less likely.
Well, one can only hope. That's all I have to say.
Yeah, you have to be optimistic. All right. Well, I'd like to thank Dota for being on.
And thank you very much for having me. It was quite an honor.
Countercurrents Radio is the voice of Countercurrents Publishing and the North American New Right. Visit us at www.countercurrents.com. That's counter-currents.com.